Hello and welcome to The Happy Middle, a podcast for women navigating the sometimes tricky in-betweenness of midlife. I'm Susie Dark, a coach, a writer, and a mother in my late 40s, so deep in this middle bit with you. This podcast is all about normalizing the trickier bits of midlife, celebrating the good stuff, and asking how we can turn the messy middle into a happier one. Expect honest conversations, interviews with some brilliant humans, and stories that I hope will help you feel more supported, reassured, and hopeful. So settle down, get comfy, and we'll get started. Hello, today's guest is Lucy Lucraft. She is a journalist turned podcast producer who helps rule-hating creative women make podcasts. She's also a midlife ADHD mum to two young kids and a British Arab who has long been calling for a free Palestine. I've been following Lucy on Instagram for years now for her honest, say how it is, often with a big dollop of sarcasm content. And she produces quite a few of my favourite podcasts, so I knew I wanted to work with her on this podcast. And getting to know her better has been a very nice extra bonus. And I'm really looking forward to our conversation today. Hi, Lucy. Thanks for coming along to The Happy Middle.
Thank you so much for having me. That was such a nice intro.
Oh, I'm glad. I'm glad it was like just the right amount of good, not too much.
It was perfect. I didn't even know that you'd been following me for years.
Yes, following, probably stalking then, if you didn't know that. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I love your Instagram stuff and your podcast too. So yeah, I've long been a fan. And I have to say, you're like working with Lucy Lucraft has been a post-it note on my planner for a long time. Yeah.
No way. Oh, yeah. That makes me so happy. My ego is huge now.
Yes, good. Enjoy that. Bask in it. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for coming along today. I'm really looking forward to talking to you about your experience, really. This podcast is all about midlife and the ups and downs and figuring out where we are and how it changes us and how we change with it. And I'm just excited to talk to you about your own experience. Shall we start by, I don't know, you telling me how you're finding it so far, how you're finding this middle bit?
Oh my goodness, weird, really weird. And I remember in my 20s getting closer to 30 and feeling really stressed, and I wasn't expecting that, but I felt, oh, I'm not where I need to be, blah 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 blah. But then coming into my 40s, I felt very, and I'm talking when I was 37 38, mm-hmm. thinking about, oh, it's my 40th this year, I was thinking, no, I feel great. I'm really excited. Everybody says your 40s are amazing. I've done so many amazing things in my life. I'm really happy. I feel like I've got lots to look forward to. And so my 40th was just great. I loved it. And so I turned 40 in August last year. Since then, I would say it feels like I turned 40 and my body was like, yeah, cool, you're in your 40s now. Boom, perimenopause. Boom, okay. Your face. Boom.
It's all happening.
You moved your head and now you can't walk for 3 days. So I'm finding that weird. Definitely, yeah. Weird is how I'm finding it.
Weird. Yeah, weird. It's interesting, isn't it? I think that 40th birthday, like, I felt similarly as well. I was like, yeah, I'm like a big woman now. I've made it. Look at me. And I'm loving people saying, you don't look 40. And now I'm like, yes. 47. And I feel like I really do look and feel 47. Like, it's very, all of a sudden it's different. My idea was like, I'm just going to completely boss the 40s. And actually, once you're in it, it's okay. Things starting to feel a little bit messy. And a lot more complicated than I imagined. Yeah,
I feel the same. Yeah, that's exactly it. Messy. Also, you definitely don't look 47 at all. But also, I suppose we should get away from that idea.
Yeah, yeah.
That's as if that's a compliment. Yeah. Like, I look 40 and that's a good thing. It's a privilege to get to 40. I'm very happy to be 40. And I'll be happy if I get to 50. But I think there's something about your... So, like, when you have kids, whatever age you have kids, I think there's a very sharp focus on your mortality all of a sudden, and I think you just don't. And I'm not saying that people who don't ever have kids don't have that, but I know for me that was the first time I was like, oh wow, I could die. I could, even though I knew intellectually that I'm going to die, I didn't feel it in my bones. And turning 40 felt, or being in my 40s, so literally I'm not even, I'm 41 in August, so I'm only 40 and a half, but that's 6 months. I suddenly feel the, oh, I'm going to be looking after my my mum, like, at some point in my 40s. And I'll also have kids who are teenagers while I'm in my 40s. Like, all of those sorts of things. Like, oh, I might, my friend who is 5 years older than me will be heading towards her 60s. And what if she dies before? And, like, it's all of those sorts of feelings. Which nobody prepares you for.
No, not at all. And I don't think, we don't land here prepared, do we? And also, I think I assumed I'd have it all figured out by now and be sorted. It's so funny. And I think 44 for me was a really weird year, because I can remember my dad being 44, and I can remember how uncool he was, how grown up I thought he was back when I was a kid. And then when I got there, it was like, oh, wow, I'm here already. How can I be here already? How can all of that have happened already? So strange.
Yeah, it really is.
Yeah. What do you feel like? So we're talking about the messy bits. So what do you feel like are the messiest bits of midlife for you so far? What are you finding, like, particularly tricky or, like, weird to navigate?
Perimenopause. So I know not everybody gets to their 40s and is immediately in perimenopause, but I am confident I probably, like most people, came into my 40s already going into perimenopause. But the way the healthcare system is set up, you really have to. And I'm really lucky because I have friends. I have lots. Most of my friends are older than me and have had to navigate this stuff already. So I knew that I had to track my symptoms, and because the first thing that they'll want me to do is do a blood test, and that blood tests aren't indicative of perimenopause. And I know the reasons why they're not indicative. So that has felt quite messy. And the symptoms that I, and I guess we'll probably talk about this, but a lot of the symptoms of menopause are the same as the symptoms of ADHD. And I was diagnosed with ADHD when I was in my 30s, my mid to late 30s. And so I'm only just getting used to that. And then suddenly it's off balance again. And because I've got used to those symptoms, I think I didn't appreciate what it would be like if they, once I had them under control or was aware of them, what if they tipped the scales and the one symptom, like my executive functioning, for example, becomes so much worse just by virtue of going into the perimenopause. And that's something that I think most people experience: brain fog, not being able to focus, loss of libido, like it going from normal for me to being non-existent. Like, I literally would be happy to never see another penis in my life ever again. And that, like, I wasn't expecting any of these things.
Yeah.
And coupled with the ADHD, that it just feels quite unfair, actually, and messy.
Yeah, unfair and messy, yeah. I mean, it's not really the kind of conversation that I had with my mum. Have you got older women of the generation above that you can have that conversation with? No. Okay, you're shaking. No.
And also, my mum, I remember her going into perimenopause when she was quite young because she had a hysterectomy.
Yeah.
So she had us when she was in her 20s, me and my sister when she was in her 20s, and then she had a hysterectomy in her 30s, which kind of pushed her into perimenopause early. And I just remember her being really shouty. And I remember her saying to me once, it's because I'm in the pre-menopause, is what she called it. And I was like, what? You've been in bloody menopause for about 20 years of my life. What the hell? That's all I remember about it.
Yeah. And people didn't really talk about it. I can remember my mum talking about the change and going through the change, the big change, which I used to laugh at, but actually now I think is quite apt, because it is. It's, everything changes. The whole thing changes. But then you can feel quite lost, can't you? So if you haven't had those conversations with... Because starting your period, my mum was all on that. told me what was going to happen, told me what to expect, got all the gear for me, etc. Whereas this, you do feel a bit marooned and a bit on your own. So you've got friends that you'd be able to have conversations with then, which is great and really helpful.
One of my friends who's 45, actually two of my friends are, one of my friends is 48, one of my friends is 45, and they have both, in the time that I've known them, thought maybe they were going through perimenopause, gone to the doctor and the doctor has tested their bloods or looked at, done a scan and been like, but look at your amazing ovaries and the follicles. And they've said to me, no, I'm not. But then have also had all these symptoms. It's only since I've got another friend who's 45, 46, who's on HRT.
Yeah.
Who told me exactly what's what. And so when I told my friends who were convinced that they weren't in perimenopause because they'd had these arbitrary medical tests and told that they weren't, they're like, oh, interesting, because I have all of those symptoms and have had them for years. But we're able to talk about the symptoms openly, which is really nice.
Yeah, really nice and helpful to have conversations like this as well that other people can listen to too, because I think it's really important, isn't it, to know how to advocate for ourselves. It's a shame that we have to like fight for this kind of stuff, but women's health unfortunately is this way. Mental health is similar as well, but like you say, tracking, knowing to track so that you can go with hard data that's actually more reliable than the kind of data that medical professionals have been trained to extract, which is not particularly helpful. Yeah, perimenopause, pretty crappy. And so you're finding it, like, what would you say, like, exaggerating your ADHD symptoms? Yeah,
and throwing them off balance a little bit.
Okay.
So the process that you go through when you're diagnosed with ADHD is you're offered titration, which means that you're offered the option of having prescription medicine for it, but it's quite a fine balance, because for most people they will start on, and the most effective medicines for most people are stimulant medicines. They're basically they're controlled substance, so you have to check your blood pressure and things like that and check in quite a lot, and it's quite a fine balance to get that dose right. And I've been taking my meds for 3-4 years and I'm still fine-tuning things, but I was on a quite level, I was quite level with the drugs and also with my symptoms, and felt like I was managing things. And then suddenly, like, just that shift in my hormones over the past year meant that it put those drugs out of whack again.
Okay.
Which, feels discombobulating. And I don't know what the reason is, and I don't think anybody knows what the reason is, because obviously there's no research into women, there's pretty crappy research into women's health, and why would they care? Because it affects us and not white men. But I feel like I can say with some level of confidence that it's the shift in certain hormones, like dopamine. I just have an inability to produce the same level of dopamine that neurotypical people do. I know that for a fact, and I know that's something that becomes not a problem in perimenopause and menopause, but becomes harder to produce. I also know that cortisol, just by virtue of being a neurodiverse in a neurotypical world, I produce more cortisol. That's the same as when you're in perimenopause and menopause.
Yeah,
I'm basically taking a view that
anecdotally, I've heard lots and lots of people saying that big hormonal events have a massive impact on ADHD. And I think there is some research that's starting to happen, like a kind of more causal research. So huge thing. But so going back to that as well. So your ADHD diagnosis was later in life as well. So what do you say, in your 30s? And that's another like big change to deal with. So like, how did that come about? How did you think to go and find out whether you were neurodivergent? Like, what were the circumstances there?
So my therapist, who I've been seeing for quite a long time, unbeknownst to me, was starting to, at that point, when I was in my, early, it was after it was in my early 30s, was starting to specialise in ADHD. And she, after we'd been working together for, I don't know, like 8 years or something, said, I wonder if it might be worth you speaking to your GP about the possibility of going for a diagnosis of ADHD and autism. Actually, she didn't say autism, she just said ADHD. And then I was like, I don't have ADHD. That's a really weird thing to say. She didn't really expand on it too much, but she just said, I've got a lot of clients and who some of these areas that we were talking about, were, that's something that comes up in ADHD women. And now I know it's probably things like RSD and, lots of things. And then I did do that, but I went privately for my ADHD diagnosis. But she supported me through the whole thing because she had so much knowledge and had helped other people. And we were, she was local to me as well. So this was pre-pandemic, so it was like proper face-to-face appointments. And so she knew the trust in Brighton and Hove, and so she knew how to navigate the system, which was amazing, because even though I did have to go private, I was able to come straight back to the NHS after I got my referral and they did my prescriptions.
Sure.
Because that's a whole other pain in the ass when it comes to ADHD referrals. Anyhow, so when I went for my ADHD referral, they were like, you're really autistic. Yeah, you're definitely autistic. No, sorry, they said, you're definitely ADHD, and we also think we think you're autistic as well.
Mm.
So then I had that diagnosis. And that was like another process.
Yeah.
But that's how it came about. I had honestly had no idea. I never would have said, because I know a lot of people realised, especially women in their late 30s, saw TikToks of real women who have ADHD and they were like, oh, that's ADHD. That's what it looks like. Yeah, okay, I might have it.
Yeah.
But it wasn't that case for me.
So did it feel like a big shock then? If it wasn't you that kind of instigated it, etc. Yeah.
Yeah, it did. I was really surprised. It was very healing. It was a nice surprise because when I found out that I had ADHD and then I learned more about it and my psychiatrist was just so lovely, so brilliant, it was very healing. And I just felt so sad for like little Lucy, little undiagnosed Lucy, who like really struggled through all of my adult life, feeling, and I would say I struggled until I found out, until I was diagnosed really, with lots of things in varying degrees. But it was almost like it's not my fault. There's a reason. I didn't get that wrong. There was a real reason why I did that in that situation, or why I couldn't do X, Y, Z. So it was really, really, really healing and just really helpful in a practical sense on how I now navigate relationships, how I navigate everything, really.
Say more on that, on relationships.
Me and my husband always say that we had couples therapy in the pandemic, and it was great, it was really good, just for a short amount of time. But the thing that has changed our marriage more than anything is my diagnosis. Because the way we relate to each other now, and the things that I do that he never understood before, because he's actually just an amazing human sent from heaven. He will do certain things, did his own research, and will do certain things because he knows I need it. Like, for example, we both work from home, right? And I find that really difficult. I don't like the idea of someone else being in the house that could walk in on me at any time. And he will text me and be like, I'm going to the gym now and I'll be back in 1 hour. And and a lot of that is my autism as well. Like, I need very clear, literal instructions / communication. And if it wasn't for my diagnosis, I would have found it very hard to articulate what I need and why.
Yeah.
And he would have found it very hard to understand what I meant. and why he should be doing something.
So interesting, isn't it? Because I can imagine a sense that this is just what you need. This is just how your brain works. This is what's helpful, that kind of thing. Whereas before diagnosis, I can imagine there might have been different feelings, or maybe not even a knowing of what you needed or wanted.
The latter, yeah. I think.
Yeah.
Mostly not knowing what. I suppose the not knowing is not quite true, is it? Because I think for me, I did know, but I'd been taught to mask to such a level and been taught that what I instinctively needed was crazy because everybody else can do it. And what a bizarre thing to need.
Yeah.
That by the time I had got into my 30s, before I was diagnosed, I was just so used to it. I didn't know what I needed. I just never would have allowed myself to need it and articulate that I needed it.
Yeah. I'm wondering, like, also how that feeds into how you're feeling now, like in your 40s, your big woman stage, or in that mix. And so there's something in that as well about having less patience, having less time to be bothered to put up with stuff anymore. Are you finding that too? Are you finding that there's a decrease in your desire to put up with stuff as well as you enter midlife?
Yeah, definitely. That is one thing that is very true about your 40s. And it's not quite the way I imagined it, because for me anyway, I didn't turn 40 and suddenly develop such a thick skin that I could tell people to just leave me alone if I wanted them to leave me alone. But I am not bothered with pursuing friendships if they just don't serve me. I'm not bothered in doing things that I don't want to do. I find it much easier to just say no to anything, really.
Okay, so this podcast is called The Happy Middle, and it's about trying to find balance and work out what the optimum might be for midlife. Not perfection, we're not looking at perfection, but what are your hopes for this middle bit? What are you hoping to get out of it, to learn from it, to experience in this middle piece of your life? You got any ideas yet?
Not really. I want to do less. I also want to I want to want less. So previously, I think I've always felt that I needed big goals, but I want to become more comfortable with not really wanting that much. Yeah, I think that's probably it. But that's actually huge, isn't it? It sounds like it's nothing, huge. But actually it's huge.
It's massive. It's so counter-cultural, so counter to everything we see everywhere. Yeah. So describe that a bit more. What would that feel like?
I think that would feel like, okay, I don't have a five-year plan for my business that involves growing this and pivoting into this. I'm happy just bumbling along as I am. And I'm also quite happy to get bigger and softer in my skin and not feel that I have to be getting back to a different body.
Oh, yeah.
That's a huge one for me because I've got a history of eating disorders. So, like, the...
Yeah, me too.
The middle... So that's hard going into your midlife because this is the first time that my metabolism has really... I have seen that it's slowed down. I can't just eat 500 grams of chocolate and two bottles of wine and not gain a few pounds. But I'd like to feel that, okay, that's it. That's my metabolism is slowing down, but I don't have to counteract. I can just accept that I'm just going to maybe get a bit bigger each year, put on a few pounds each year, and that's okay. And it's okay if we're not upgrading our house to be honest, me and my husband have never been forever home people, so we've always been quite countercultural in that sense. We don't care, but I'm not immune from it.
Yeah.
And the idea that, oh, wouldn't it be nice if we had a drive and a big garden and that sort of stuff?
Yeah.
Yeah, that's probably what it looks like for me.
It feels really, I don't know, it just feels really rebellious, I would say.
Yeah.
Rebellious, yeah. But also not in a, oh my God, that's going to take loads of effort. Like in a real sinking into it kind of way. Like you're like a real rejection of all the crap that's around. But I like that softening, like a softer life.
Mm.
Yeah, totally. I would love to be there too. I still feel like the pull of the, I think, private or girls' school education, like push, push, you should be like aiming for here. That's so ingrained in me, like this real like ambition that's not particularly pleasant. Mm. It does rear its head often. And I get it too. It's just being content with the goodness that's here right now, rather than ignoring all of that and almost kicking it out of the way and looking for the what's next.
It's really hard though, because especially if you come from that private or girls' school brutal upbringing that is all about achievement and external validation and metrics, and that's really hard to shake off. Really hard. Yeah. And that seeps into every part of your life as well.
Mm, yeah, it does. It really does. And it speaks to something about transferring that validation, almost taking back ownership of it and saying, okay, I'm going to bring that within me now, and I'm going to figure out what it means, what success looks like, what that's going to feel like. And it's a process, definitely a process. And it's hard when you're like we're both like in the online world, Lisa. So we're on Instagram quite a lot, etc. And my inbox is full of newsletters, and it's all about the next big thing, isn't it? Do more, do bigger, earn bigger, etc. Like it's literally the sea that we're swimming in.
I have to say though that I have rejected that over a number of years. So anybody that is that type of person is just not somebody that I follow. I've rejected that. And I feel like I've got a well-trained spidey sense for if somebody is that type of person. And it's not necessarily, I'm not saying that they're bad people, but it's something that I reject that. So blueprint people who promise any kind of monetary or even talk about money in a money mindset, blah, blah, blah. I just don't consume that content at all. Because it's so unhealthy, I think. Yeah. And it's also rooted in such a lot of unchecked privilege.
Yeah, it feels, actually it does feel like there's a shift, and people are starting to say, actually, that's not what I'm here for. I'm wondering as well how that's going to look for you, for me, for us, as we get into our 50s and our 60s, like what our concerns are going to look like then. It feels quite exciting. I feel excited about what 60-year-old Susie's going to be doing and caring about. hopeful about it.
Yeah, I do. I feel the same. But I do just want to say, though, that I think when you said you think things are shifting, I think that's undoubtedly you that has shifted those things out of your eyeline as well. Because I think those things still exist. I know what you mean. There's definitely like an overall online trend piece where that's not as prevalent. But I think it's probably more not as prevalent for us because we've rejected it. And so we see less of that. Having said that, you do see the discourse in younger generations massively changing and being so much more open to talking about things that I would never have talked about when I was younger. I would not have been talking about politics in such a sophisticated way when I was in my 20s. I certainly wouldn't have been taking really direct, bold action in my 20s, organising grassroots movements, or like completely opening my eyes to being an anti-capitalist, or thinking, understanding there are completely different ways to be in the world. So I'm hopeful for that.
Yeah, me too. And I look down at the generation, the younger generations, and do feel super hopeful, because I was the same. Like in my 20s, I switched off. I think my teens, I was quite political, very like argumentative, and got really angry about stuff. And then in my 20s, I just switched off from all of that. And then 30s was like just babies and just being knackered all the time. And now it feels like 40s, I'm back to feeling really angry again, like really angry and wanting to do something about it. So I agree with you that we all create our own bubbles, don't we? And I think the bubble I've created feels a lot more aligned to the things that we've just been speaking about. And it does feel like things are shifting. I'm hopeful that they are. Really hopeful.
Yeah,
that they
I think
are.
So.
Thank you very much, Lucy, for coming along. It's been a brilliant conversation. Lovely to hear about your experience of this middle bit and like what you're hoping for the future. I'm going to take away definitely this idea of a softer life and what you're hoping for as well, because that feels just really delicious and something I could go for too. So thank you very much.
Thank you. It's been so much fun.